From VOA, the Science Edition of Press Conference USA. Here's your host, Rick Pantaleo.
Welcome to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Rick Pantaleo. The most popular material used today in consumer products is plastic. Plastic seems to be everywhere in our lives. The material is widely used because it's an inexpensive alternative to more costly materials such as glass, metals, and wood. Because plastic products are so prevalent in our society, a significant and increasing amount of plastic waste is produced each year. With so much plastic to dispose of, more and more of these materials are being dumped into the environment, either directly or because of inadequate reuse or recycling efforts. According to the website Britannica.com, the problem of plastic pollution was first noticed in the ocean by scientists carrying out studies in the late 1960s and early 1970s. The International Union for Conservation of Nature says at least 14 million tons of plastic wind up in the ocean every year, and that plastic debris is now the most abundant type of litter found there. The IUCN says plastic waste can be found in the ocean's surface waters and down into deep-sea sediments. Unlike other materials, plastics can take longer to break down in the environment. A study published in the journal BMC suggests that as plastic breaks down, they can degrade into micro or nanoplastic particles that range from 5 millimeters to 1 nanometer in diameter. Recent media reports point out deepening environmental and health concerns caused by these tiny plastic fragments. So, on today's Science Edition of Press Conference USA, we will discuss the rise and risk of plastic and microplastic pollution. My guest for today's show is Robert Hale, a professor in the Department of Aquatic Health at the Virginia Institute of Marine Science in Gloucester Point, Virginia. Rob, before we get to microplastics, let's first talk about plastic pollution in general and a very basic question. What are plastics made of?
Yeah, plastics are made of primarily chemicals called polymers, which are long-chain molecules generally based on carbon, but they can be based on other things like silicon as well. And to that basic polymer, we can also add smaller molecules called additives that will change the basic properties of the plastic. For example, we can add flame retardants to it. We can add plasticizers to make it more flexible. We can add colorants to change the color of the plastic if we're so inclined. And oftentimes, they're added at several percent by weight of the actual molecule.
You know, we realize in our lifestyle today that there's no way we can get away from products that aren't made of plastic. Where is most plastic used and how so?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. Most plastics are used actually not in single-use plastic bottles. They use slightly more plastics and things that have longer lives, like in our homes and plastic piping, in insulation for cars and boats and things like that, carpeting, clothes, tires, electronics. It's about 52% or so used in that. And the other 48 or so are used in so-called single-use plastics, which are things like beverage bottles, plastic bags, things that we generally have been using once and then throwing away.
We realize that we use so much plastic, so apparently the plastic waste should be definitely high. How much plastic waste is produced annually?
There's not really that great numbers. People have tried to kind of extrapolate based on expectations of production and disposal. One of the estimates has been that there's been about 8 million tons of plastic escaping every year into the oceans. But a lot of the plastic actually ends up on land.
How do they get into the environment? I mean, they're usually thrown into the garbage and from the garbage into a landfill and disposed of some way. So how does it become a problem?
Yeah, a lot of plastics is basically illegally littered. You'll see this a lot in rural areas. We'll go by and you'll see things like couches in the woods. So there's a lot of littering that goes on. There's also a lot of loss if it's not an appropriate, well-contained waste dump. So here in the United States, we have pretty tight controls on our waste dumps. But in other countries, there really aren't those requirements. And so things like the wind can blow plastics out, or a lot of the stuff can be washed off of land by rainfall and storms. If you remember the great Japanese tsunami a few years ago, the vast amount of plastics that were basically washed out of Japan and tossed into the Pacific. There are also issues in terms of losses during transportation. So we transport a lot of our plastic goods by ship. You see these big container ships, and sometimes containers actually fall off ships and are lost at sea.
Why is plastic in the environment such a problem?
Well, there's multiple reasons. I've mentioned the additives before, mm-hmm. and some of those chemical additives are actually toxic. Again, going back to the example of bromine flame retardants, those are actually fairly toxic. So if the additive can get out of the plastic and you can be exposed to it in your home, or if it gets out in the environment, then wildlife can get exposed to it. The other issue with plastics is they tend to degrade over time. They fragment. People think plastics are forever. Well, nothing really is forever, but plastics will tend to weather and fall apart and form so-called microplastics. And so the parent, the large plastic, can be consumed by things like whales and sea turtles. And birds are a big issue as well and cause primarily problems with their digestive tracts, or animals might get entangled in things like derelict fishing nets. And if you think about a sense of scale, the microplastics are actually, small versions of those plastics. So smaller organisms down in the food chain can actually consume those smaller plastics. And you can see some of the same physical effects on those animals that you saw with the whales and the turtles and such. They can block up digestive tracts. They can lacerate respiratory surfaces and digestive surfaces and cause a lot of toxicological problems there.
Since you brought it up, Rob, microplastics, we've been hearing a lot about that lately in the media, in the news. Is there a specific size? What are microplastics? Can you give us an overview of what they are?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. We as humans like to drop things into categories. In reality, the environment, the world works as a continuum. So you've got plastics of all different sizes, running from yachts to little abrasives that are used in things like toothpaste. Formerly, we've classed microplastics as materials that are 5 millimeters down to about 1 micron. But you can imagine in the environment, these things break down. So if I've got something that was, 10 millimeters today and it broke in half, it would now be 2 5-millimeter pieces. And all of a sudden, magically, it's a microplastic. So it's useful to define things generically, but in reality, that's not how the world works.
We were talking a little bit earlier about disposing of plastics, and we talked about the landfills and such. And I'm sure a number of people actually try to get rid of plastics by burning it. Is that a major issue in the environment?
Yeah, it is. There's two ways of burning things. You can do it under very controlled circumstances where you're controlling the amount of oxygen, and some of the more developed countries actually have incinerators for generating energy from typically solid waste, as well as some plastics that are included in there. But unfortunately, if you burn plastics in an uncontrolled manner, like it's very popular to throw like plastic trash into a barrel and light it on fire to get rid of it, that actually can produce some very toxic chemicals known as dioxins and furans. And these chemicals are actually carcinogenic. And so it's very dangerous for people in the vicinity of that activity, as well as the environment itself.
When was the problem with microplastics in the environment first identified? When did it become an issue?
I guess it probably became an issue around the year 2000. We started noticing it. We used to think that the whole problem were the large plastics because we could see what it did to large marine life, again, like whales and dolphins and things, that they got entangled in it. And we always thought for a long time was that, well, if it just broke down into little pieces, it wouldn't be a problem. And then what happened is people started looking a little closer and they were seeing the little pieces everywhere. And they realized that that plastic was not just disappearing. It was just actually breaking down into smaller and smaller pieces. And if you think about the animals in the world, most of the animals are small in the world, and these small plastics can now be eaten by those smaller organisms. So actually the damage in terms of the whole ecosystem could actually be worse from the microplastics than it ever was from the large plastics.
Okay, you're talking about damage to ecosystems and damage to wildlife. How do plastics affect not only wildlife, but human beings?
Yeah, it's a very complex area, and that's under study now. If you look at the papers that people have published, a lot of them are documenting, where they're finding the microplastics. And so you hear the stories about finding it in the deep ocean and in Antarctica and remote alpine regions, things like that. And now we're trying to sit down as scientists and figure out, well, what are really the toxicological effects of microplastics? And it's a very evolving field. They also sometimes fill up an animal so they feel like they're actually full, but the plastic has no nutrient value. So animals will just stop eating because they're full of plastic and effectively starve to death. So that's one problem. The other problem goes back to the additives I mentioned before. So a lot of the additives we also thought never came out of plastics, just like we thought plastics always remained, you know, intact. But now we know that over time, those additives can come out. And, you know, we mentioned the brominated flame retardants. Those actually affect the development of the nervous system. So children are particularly vulnerable to brominated flame retardants because they can affect the development of the brain. It can actually cause impacts on IQ. And if you think about a child, where they spend most of their time, basically on the carpeting, which is made out of plastic, they're fed with a lot of plastic utensils and bottles. Oftentimes, you know, the milk is given in basically plastic bottles. The brominated flame retardants actually build up in the breast milk of women. And so children that are breastfed also get a higher dose of those as well. And there's other examples of additives, like the phthalates that are used as plasticizers in plastic are actually so-called endocrine disruptors. Some additives have metals in them, like lead. So there's a diverse range of toxicological effects that can occur either because of the plastic themselves or the chemicals that are in them.
As I was preparing for our talk today, I understand that we humans and animal life are actually eating and breathing microplastics. Can you explain this?
Yeah, there's been quite a bit of interest in regards to the accumulation of microplastics in our food. So, for example, you know, microplastics are in the environment. Fish can consume those, and, you know, technically they're inside the fish or they're in shellfish. One of the interesting things is most people don't eat the digestive tract of the fish, so they probably avoid a lot of the plastics that are in there. But if the plastics, microplastics get into the, you know, the muscle tissue that we commonly eat, that's a problem. So a lot of attention has gone there. But one of the bigger issues I think that's been overlooked is the fact that we spend in developed countries about 90% of our life inside our homes and our businesses or inside a car. And if you just spend a couple of minutes looking around, you know, wherever you're sitting, you'll just see that you're really living inside a plastic bubble. This plastic will release those additives I've mentioned before to your internal environment, your air, over long periods of time. And a lot of the plastics we have in our home, you know, we live them with them for a long time, like our carpeting. Maybe your carpeting's in your house for, you know, 10 or 20 years. Over time, it wears and forms microplastics from that abrasion, and that gets into the indoor dust in your home, and that can get suspended, and so you can inhale that dust or actually accidentally ingest a surprisingly large amount of indoor dust just from your food. And humans are probably actually the most exposed organisms in the world to microplastics and chemical additives. But again, you don't hear that very often. Our focus has often been on the oceans.
Speaking of impact and risks to human health, I read a couple of weeks ago a new Dutch study that found microplastics in human blood for the first time. Do you care to comment about that?
Yeah, it's really interesting. It's very difficult to analyze for the very small microplastics that make it into our tissues. Normally, our body blocks out the larger plastics from actually getting into our cells and into our blood and our major tissues. Usually those reside in our digestive tract and they'll end up being excreted later on. But very, very small ones that are on the order of, say, 10 microns or less, which again are very difficult to detect, can cross into our body. And that's what these folks found in blood. Actually, it wasn't that surprising to me because some previous work had shown microplastics in the placenta of women who had given birth. And the only route for those microplastics to get into that placenta, and then, by the way, into the newborn, and actually during the time of gestation, that placenta is kind of the communication route for nutrients from the mother to the child. The only way for that really to get in is by passage from blood into the placenta and then into the infant at that point. So it's just really a matter of time that folks actually detected microplastics in human blood.
Let's take a break. You're listening to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'd like to remind you that Press Conference USA is available for free download at voanews.com/PCUSA. You can also find our show on Apple Podcasts and other podcast websites. We hope you'll connect with us on Facebook at VOA Current Affairs or Facebook and Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA. You can also just send us an email to pcusa@voanews.com. Now, let's get back to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Today, we're discussing the rise and risks of plastic and microplastic pollution. My guest for today's show is Robert Hale, a professor in the Department of Aquatic Health at the Virginia Institute of Marine Science in Gloucester Point, Virginia. Rob, I understand that there are certain consumer products like cosmetics that actually use microplastics in their content.
These are small plastics that are intentionally made small as opposed to a lot of the microplastics. Probably about 99% of the microplastics out in the environment are actually fragments from bigger plastics. But we do manufacture small plastics for specific uses that are things like abrasives, like things that are used on your skin to defoliate your skin to make it look nice, as well as in cosmetics. So one example are nylon microfibers that are used in the eyelash extenders. And some of those are actually have some perfluorinated chemicals in them because the manufacturers like the water repellency of the product. So when you see makeup that's listed as permanent makeup and things like that, oftentimes those will have chemical additives along with the microplastics in there to extend their life. You know, if you think about it, it's one of the places you probably don't want microplastics and toxic additives are, you know, around your mouth or your eyes.
Let's get back to microplastics in general and their impact on the environment. How serious of a problem is it? And is this, I would assume so, but is it global in nature? And what parts of the world are most affected by it?
Yeah, you know, again, the developed countries are the ones that manufacture most of the plastics. And so when you look at the indoor environment, the residents of developed countries are probably most exposed to microplastics and the most toxic versions of those. Again, the products that last a long time that have things like bromine flame retardants in it. So we in developed countries, Western countries, typically manufacture most of the plastic, use the lion's share of it. And until very recently, we were exporting a lot of that plastic to less developed countries like China, other places in Southeast Asia, under the guise of recycling. And so they were receiving not only the plastics that they use themselves, but also plastics that we exported supposedly for recycling, a lot of which wasn't recycled. A lot of it was actually just kind of lost in the environment. And a lot of the developing countries don't really have the infrastructure, the well-controlled waste dumps to handle the plastics and the industries really to necessarily recycle those. So they have a hard time handling their own plastics as opposed to the developed countries exporting plastic to them. But some of the published work was showing that in regards to the release of plastics to the oceans, that those same countries, the Southeast Asian countries in particular, were responsible for a lot of the loss of plastics to the marine environment. Again, we contributed massively to that by exporting a lot of our waste to them.
Rob, how successful is recycling? How's it done? And is this an absolutely positive aspect of getting rid of excess plastic?
Yeah, if you think about it logically, it's very difficult and expensive to remanufacture new products out of waste plastic. Normally, when you collect your waste, again, it's usually separated by polymer type. But if you look at those plastic products, oftentimes they have all different types of color and texture and additives and things like that in them. And so the idea of taking those and effectively melting them down and creating new products has lots of problems with it. It ends up not being a pure polymer product, but rather a mixture of all the different polymers and chemicals that were actually included in that particular lot for recycling. And so the product that's produced is a mixture of diverse things, some of which may not be very compatible with each other. I think the current numbers I've seen for recycling plastics is on the order of 8 or 9% of those produced, which is, you know, a long shot away from basically complete recycling. And again, a lot of these products are just totally incompatible in their current form for recycling because they contain, you know, a bunch of, say, toxic additives in them.
Rob, statistically speaking, has there been a progressive increase in the amount of microplastic pollution over the years?
Yes, definitely. You know, and it will go in step with the increase of the production of the, well, I call them parent plastics. So we've been kind of on this logarithmic increase, you know, doubling the amount of plastic we produce, you know, on the order of every 10 years now during this great acceleration of production. And the vast majority of microplastics are fragmentation of those, weathering, abrasion of those products that eventually break into, you know, millions and trillions of little microplastics. So it will go in step with the increase in plastic production.
We talked about recycling plastic. We talked about how plastics get into the environment. And I guess a fundamental question is, how long does it take for plastics to break down in the environment?
You know, like everything else related to plastics, it's complicated. It depends very much on the polymer type. Some are fairly vulnerable to breakdown from, say, light or biological degradation. Some of the plastics we use that might be more vulnerable to that, we actually put some additives in it to prevent that. So there are UV oxidation additives put in some plastics to basically block that pathway. So it's very dependent on the particular type of plastic and the additives that are in it. It's also dependent on how it's used and where it's disposed. So you can imagine a piece of plastic on a beach. If it stays there, it gets a lot of exposure to light, which tends to weather it, and it can get abraded on a beach, you know, from the wave action, and that can, you know, cause fragmentation of the plastic there. But if it's, say, buried in the soil or it's buried in the sediments of the ocean, in the deep ocean, it's not going to get any oxygen. You know, it's not going to get any light. The temperature tends to be very low. And so the breakdown of that plastic will be very, very slow. So in those cases, we may be talking about centuries or millennia before it actually appreciably breaks down.
We're talking about the spread of plastic pollution. I understand landfills and even fishing activity play active roles in producing plastic waste. Can you explain this?
Well, fishing activities are fairly straightforward, I think. A lot of fishing gear is made out of plastic, you know, the nets, the lines, the floats that are used for fishing gear. And a surprisingly large amount of that material is just lost every year, either because it got hung up on something or there's a weather event and basically the net was washed away from its original location, or someone just plain out forgot where they put it. And so you have what we call a lot of derelict fishing gear out there, and it's a huge problem. So for example, if you go to the coast of Alaska, you'll see washed up on the beach of the coast of Alaska, massive deep water fishing nets that were used, you know, probably on the other side of the Pacific Ocean. And because the currents are actually washing up, these things may be, you know, half a mile long. So that's a great source of debris for the environment in general, and the ocean in particular. And then landfills, again, it depends to some regard to how well it's constructed. To actually construct a really tight landfill is very, very expensive. So really only the developed nations typically have those. And, you know, a lot of plastics is very light. You know, you see plastic bags, you know, blowing around all over the place. And so if you don't secure the surface of the landfill where the plastic is put in there, it will simply blow off site and now become effectively litter.
You were talking a little earlier about the spread of plastics from developed countries into just developing countries. So let's talk a little bit about environmental justice related to plastic waste, especially to those countries that have never even used those products.
Yeah, one of the big issues is, you know, a lot of the Western and European nations, you know, United States, Canada, Germany, so on and so forth, we've been historically the big users of plastics, a lot of it for our own convenience and things like single use beverage containers and things along that line. I've mentioned before that historically, and still to this day, we export a lot of our waste to other countries that were willing for one reason or another to accept that waste. In some cases, it was things like electronic waste. So we've heard about e-waste problems where old obsolete computers were shipped over to other countries, and the folks there, under very primitive conditions, try to break apart those electronics and salvage things that have value, like copper. But then oftentimes the leftover casings of the computers and the cell phones were either discarded in the environment or just plain burned. And so these people are being left with the problem of the waste plastics without really having significantly benefited from the use of those plastics. You know, the other issue is marketing plastics to developing countries. So right now there's a big push to market our products to developing countries. You know, there's lots of population there. There's a lot of good uses for plastics. So, for example, the use of water bottles to provide pure water is very beneficial, but then you have to deal with the plastic waste after the fact. But one of the things that the folks marketing products have seen is, well, a lot of individuals in the developing countries don't have a lot of money, but they would still like to benefit from products that we can sell, things like clothes washing detergent as an example. So, for example, they may not be able to buy the big bottle of detergent, but they can buy a very small bottle of detergent and then use that to clean a few laundry loads, usually done by hand, but then they're left with the waste of the bottle itself. In reality, what we should be doing is, you know, avoiding selling these small containers of material, you know, millions and millions of those, and seek to distribute materials in bulk so we don't have so much plastic there.
Rob, what is being done to address the environmental and health concerns of microplastic pollution? And have you seen any workable solutions to the problem or any in the offing?
You know, there are some simple things that we could do to dramatically reduce the amount of plastic waste. You know, recycling is one avenue, but reuse is a big possibility. If you think about a plastic bottle, if I were to use that plastic bottle twice, I would actually reduce the amount of waste plastics in half. Normally, when we start talking about reducing plastic use, we're talking about a few percent here and a few percent there. But if all plastics were used twice somehow, that would actually cut the plastic use in half. You know, of course, all plastics are not amenable to that. But reuse, I think, would be a very, very important approach. Another approach that is being looked at is to move away from basically fossil fuel sources for plastics, which has a lot of problems to it, including climate change, to so-called bioplastics that might be more biodegradable in the environment. So that's an option. And we talk about those as being more sustainable approaches because I can grow, say, the plants to make the biopolymer and regrow them as the case may be. But one of the important things about degradation of plastics is not just the polymer itself, but the environment in which it is disposed of, shall we say. So again, going back to my example about the deep ocean, if you put a bioplastic container into the sediments of the deep ocean, its degradation rate will probably be almost non-existent. So that's the other part of the equation in regards to degradability is really the environment that we put it in. You know, people talk about compostable plastics. Well, if you've got a perfect compostable situation there, then yeah, some of that plastic will break down pretty readily. But again, a lot of our plastic is discarded into other environments other than that beneficial situation.
And finally, Rob, how is the problem being addressed by governments and private industry?
There are some international efforts to limit basically the industry of transport of waste to developing countries under the United Nations Environmental Program. And one of their concerns also has been plastics in particular that have hazardous chemicals in them, like the brominated flame retardants I've mentioned and lead and some of that.
Rob, I want to thank you so much for providing us with such valuable insight into plastics and microplastics and their impact on the environment and on human health as well.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity of speaking with you and your audience.
That was Robert Hale, a professor in the Department of Aquatic Health at the Virginia Institute of Marine Science in Gloucester Point, Virginia. And that's all the time we have for this science edition of Press Conference USA. I hope you enjoyed today's show. Thanks for listening. This is Rick Pantaleo reminding you to join Carol Castillo next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.